calls it. Institutions, human society, create that add-on value, added on to the matter of the $20 bill. It's institutional reality. We can also say that that institutional reality, the value, the exchangeable value of the $20 bill is observer dependent or observer relative. Each of those says approximately the same thing. That value that you can use the $20 bill, you can use this piece of matter to, you know, to go into a store and buy food, depends upon, its existence depends upon a perceiver, an observer. Whereas the matter which constitutes a $20 bill owes its existence to no perceiver. It simply is matter. It exists, whether it's detected, perceived, experienced, or not. And therefore, the matter, the plastic, the paper, the ink, those things are observer independent. Now, obviously, there's something about the physical matter, the ontologically objective component of the money, and the ontologically subjective, observer-dependent component of the money, that tie them together. They don't seem to be completely distinct. They sort of merge together, and you have in your hand this $20 bill, and you can walk into a store and walk out with groceries or whatever. There's something that ties these two things together. And what that is, according to Searle, is that they are both epistemically objective, epistemically in the sense of can be known, can be studied. There is a reality to the value of money, even though it might be constructed reality, even though it might be ontologically subjective reality. There's a value nonetheless, which some might argue is just as sure, just as certain, just as tangible as the physical paper that you can touch. It's very real. I mean, if you can eat or not eat, survive or not survive, if the value of money, which we're saying is ontologically subjective, is existentially important to your existence, then there's something epistemically objective about it. The value of money, the value that's assigned by human institutions, by a human economy, by a society, therefore, is ontologically subjective, but epistemically objective. So much of the world can be divided into these two types of entities. Another example that comes to mind is if you arrive at an international border, you could say that the land and the trees and the objects on one side of the border versus the other side of the border have ontologically objective existence, and there's really no border known in that paradigm. In the ontologically objective world, there's no border. There are trees, there's rocks, there's ground, there's dirt. Those things are all ontologically objective, whereas the imaginary border that separates them, let's say you drive down to the Canada-US border, if the trees and the rocks could think and be aware, which they probably can't, although some might take exception to that, they're unaware of any international border. The international border is an ontologically subjective construction of institutions, of humans. Presumably, if there were no people, there would be no border. The border would disappear with the disappearance of the minds of people. Now, I've used the word presumably a few times when distinguishing ontologically objective and subjective, because I want to allow for the possibility, which some people believe is the case or might be the case, that even matter itself, the stuff which I'm calling ontologically objective, is in whole or in part observer dependent. And that's a whole nother argument. The distinction might not be quite as clear as I'm making it out to be in this short talk, because there is a view, of course, if we get into epistemology, that various perceived properties of matter are actually observer dependent. So things like shape, color, certainly color is an example of that's in dispute. Some might argue that color is in the mind of the perceiver, not in the object itself. But let's say that the matter, the underlying matter, is ontologically objective. Even there, someone would argue that this would be an idealist, you know, an idealist would argue that even matter is observer dependent. But I am sticking to more mainstream views with respect to the objectivity of matter and the subjectivity of human minds constructing ideas and attaching values, assigning values to matter. But now I'm going to present what I think is perhaps not a challenge, but certainly a nuance and certainly a complication, perhaps a challenge to John Searle's ideas and distinction between ontologically objective and ontologically subjective entities. Enter Donald Davidson and a theory of mind which he promotes called anomalous monism. And I'm going to simplify this down to a basic nugget for the purposes of this short talk. It's considered to be a non-reductionist token identity theory of mind, which means in this case that Davidson argues that there are events that happened in the physical mind, and they can be described in multiple ways using multiple languages. So a neurologist might observe a human mind and describe the physiological or the physical processes that are happening at a certain time, but the person whose mind it is might speak and describe an event like, I am feeling scared, or I have a pain in my leg. But according to anomalous monism, the psychological description is a description of the identical token event that the neurologist might be describing when the neurologist observes the brain and discovers the physiological processes happening. So in other words, there is one single physiological process happening in the brain, which can be described either in scientific terms or can be described in psychological terms. When a person says, I'm feeling a pain, they are describing an identical event, a pain event, to what is being described if a scientist could observe the brain and see what was happening physiologically in the brain at that very moment of pain. Identical event, two distinct ways of describing it. So it's an identity theory of mind. The psychological experience is anomalous because it doesn't cause anything. Some people would argue that it's an epiphenomenal claim. Davidson takes exception to that, and I can't go into detail right now about why he objects to accusations of epiphenomenalism. But the idea that Davidson promotes is that psychological events can't be causative, can't be in causal relations with other psychological events because there's no general laws that apply to them, to psychological events. There's also no general laws that apply to between psychological and physiological events. Therefore, all interactions, according to Davidson, are physiological. Physiological events cause other physiological events. And psychological descriptions are simply alternate language to describe those physiological events. So the psychological descriptions are anomalous. The psychological experiences are anomalous. They are perceived by, you know, by the perceiver, but they are simply physical events being described in psychological terms. So now to tie this together with Searle's ideas about ontologically objective or subjective. If anomalous monism is correct, then my belief that $20 has a value above and beyond the matter, its constitutive matter, if that's my belief, then my brain must be in a certain state. There's an event happening in my brain, which I psychologically describe as a belief. A belief in the value of $20 that could be cashed in for something or redeemed for something. I believe that. Therefore, my mind is in a certain state. My brain is in a certain state. There's a physiological event happening in my brain, which I describe as a belief that this $20 will buy me a couple sandwiches at the deli. That's a belief. The belief, according to anomalous monism, would be a psychological description of a state of mind, a physiological state of the brain. A state of mind is identical to a state of the brain. So, if that's the case, if my brain is in a certain configuration, and that causes me to open my mouth and say, I believe that this $20 will buy me two hamburgers, which, as I said before, is an ontologically subjective construction, the idea that it's worth anything, that $20 is worth anything, then, in theory, a neurologist could look at the physical event, the biological event, the physiological event happening in my brain, which is identical to my opening my mouth and describing my belief. If that's the case, the physiological state of my brain is ontologically objective, not subjective. So how can we say that the value of $20 beyond its material value, how can we say that the value that human minds assigned to a $20 bill is not ontologically objective, while we're also saying that the state of mind is a physiological state, which is ontologically objective. So it seems at first glance that even the constructed value of money, the value constructed by people in their minds and therefore in their brains, is ontologically objective because it's happening in their brain physiologically. But here's the distinction. The belief that money has a value beyond the material part of the $20 bill, for example, that belief is ontologically objective because it's a physiological brain state. But the value, not the belief about the value, but the value itself of the $20 bill is ontologically subjective. It has no corresponding physiological brain state, which is objective. It's just out there in some you know, some subjective world. So I have a belief about $20 having a value. That belief is a physiological, objective fact in my brain, an event in my brain. But the value that I have the belief about, that my intentionality is directed towards, that is ontologically subjective. So that's how one can reconcile Searle's ideas with Davidson's ideas, I believe. Another way of making the distinction is that my belief about the value of $20 beyond its material components is a physiological state of my mind, which is not observer dependent. It's observer independent. An observer could be any old neurologist that had the ability, the technology, the sense extenders, the equipment, if it existed. A neuroscientist observing my brain could see the state of my brain as an observer independent entity. That state of my brain would exist whether or not any neuroscientist or anyone else was observing my brain. So my belief that $20 has value to it is not only ontologically objective, but it's also observer independent. The value, which is the object of my belief, the value of the money, is observer dependent because it has no value without an observer assigning it such value. And not only that, but it's extrinsic to the money itself. The $20 bill has no intrinsic property of being worth anything more than just the matter upon which it's printed. The value of the money, the belief about the value of the money, is intrinsic to the observer, but extrinsic to the money itself. So a question might arise as to why all this is important or what's the significance of all this. And one of the important features, I think, of this, one of the important consequences of this model that I'm laying out is that it gives us consistency in our philosophies of mind. So if one purports to be a materialist, that is to say, one does not believe that there is a immaterial substance which exists in parallel to material substances. In other words, if one is not a dualist, but one is a strict materialist and believes that the physical world is a closed system and the human brain and the human mind and human beings and their thoughts and beliefs and consciousness and feelings and intentionality and all that reside or are situated in the physical world and are subject to the laws of physics. If one believes that latter set of beliefs, then it becomes problematic to think of subjective entities that don't have any material reality, but just exists out there someplace in human minds. Seems to me that in order to contend that human minds contain some sort of subjective material that does not exist in the objective world, if one is doing that, one is introducing inconsistency, because how can you say on one hand everything is material, but on the other hand say that there are subjective entities that aren't material? Where are they? What are they? Where do they exist? It seems like you're implying some type of dualism, but then you deny dualism. So there's a contradiction. So I think earlier I suggested a way that a materialist, one who denies immaterial substance, one who denies that the human mind is immaterial, it's a way for that person to say, okay, well, even things that we call constructions of the mind are themselves physiological brain states. And not only that, but cultural values being shared features of the human mind, or of human minds, of many human minds, shared features, common features, we can look at as common physiological brain states. Now, there's a bit of a qualification here because according to Donald Davidson's theory, there's a token identity between mind states and brain states, or psychological states and physiological brain states, meaning that each event is unique. But we can say that some are similar to others, although they are unique instances. So there may be similarities between many instances of pain, but no instance is identical to the other. But maybe they share certain characteristics. So a neuroscientist might observe certain commonalities in the brain waves or whatever the physiological processes are happening that seem to be common among states that are described psychologically as pain. So likewise, a cultural belief in the value of a $20 bill or other cultural beliefs may be descriptions of token brain states in the people within that culture, the people who believe those things. But they're token. They're not identical, obviously. They're in different brains, which is another reason why token identity theory has an advantage over the type identity theories, which is that, many different brains and even different species or even, an extraterrestrial being who is not human might share certain experiences that they're very much alike other individual experience. They're very much like other individuals' experiences, but they're not identical. So cultural beliefs, such as the value of money, may be sort of held together, if you will, by the similarity between token physiological brain states of the members of that culture. So by understanding that even what we are tempted to call ontologically subjective human constructions, like the value of money, or borders, or countries, even those things are descriptions of physiological brain states which are ontologically objective. There is no such thing as an immaterial state of mind. And therefore, we have consistency in a theory of materialism which denies a dual and competing or parallel immaterial world. Even ideas themselves, beliefs themselves, are identical to physiological brain states.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
Bye. شبای یا شبی پر ستاره، یه رودخونه یه قایق به زیر نور مهتاب، قشنگ‌ترین دقایق این لحظه های اوجه برای قلب عاشق. دل خوشی هم یه شاخ گل کافیه.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.
Mm-hmm.